Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEFCON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEFCON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEFCON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
I believe it was donated by an anonymous person. Okay, next up we have Curtis Parnell. If you were here last year, he's a veteran speaker. He's humorous, he's an attorney, but he's not all that bad. He works for Nintendo, no? Sega.
Oh!
I'm getting out of here. And, get crazy.
One of my other clients was Phil Zimmerman. I do different sorts of work than Phil Dubois does. Phil is going to have cards in the back of the room on one of those tables, so that for people who want that card, for example, to contribute to Zimmerman's Legal Defense Fund, please take one of those cards. If people want to talk about the intellectual property issues, like the patent issues that Phil was talking about, I can address those, but we'll do it at a break. That's not the topic of my discussion. For those of you who saw the big box up here and saw me quietly steal it away, it's a copy of this talk. If you read it, you won't listen to me, so it's available after I've finished, with all of the footnotes and the thousands of little cute references and so on that I'm not going to get into, obviously, in the talk. See, number two, a lot of the stuff that Gail Thackery discussed, I disagree with quite strongly. I'm a former federal prosecutor and, for example, never saw a judge come down and watch over our shoulders or any of the FBI shoulders and what they were doing. A lot of the stuff she was talking about, I disagree with. Again, I can't get into it in detail now, but both she and I are going to be around, for example, at the break. We could probably continue a lot of the Q&A, maybe perhaps at that time. I think I'm the last speaker for this morning. But the sort of control issues that she was talking about that really lie at the heart of the problem she has with the way digital communications work is the topic of my conversation. And I will be talking about that issue of control. I'll be talking about the way the law tries to control it, the way the law fails to control it, and what some of the solutions are to that kind of control. As she pointed out, the physical and natural laws to date have usually governed what is possible. Natural laws, physical laws, have governed notions of politics and property. That's where we get this idea of a reality check. As a limit, the physical reality has sorted out things like dreams and the real, the valid from the invalid, the true from the false. And so the legal system, which true does always follow behind developments in technology, the legal system has always been based on these ideas of limits. It's always been based on the idea of property. And when intangible things became valuable, the system bred this idea of intellectual property to cover these sorts of intangible things. So it extended its stuff to reach intangible and indiscernible things like trade secrets. We can own, we can sue over, we can possess things like trade secrets, like debts, like expectations of profits. You can sue somebody for a loss of expectation of profit, an intangible kind of property that the law really has no problem with at this point. All these things do have some sort of link, though, to the physical world. The civil rights that you have are linked to your personal body. The patent, you can read about it in a physical piece of paper, and if it's not on the paper, it doesn't exist. The Constitution rights and so on are all generally centered on the individual human being that moves from the telephone booth where he has an expectation of property to the house where you have an expectation of property to your car where you don't have much of an expectation of property. But we're leaving that physical world behind, and with it this sort of touchstone of boundaries and of property. Increasingly, the things that we're dealing with and the value that we are creating, the value that the culture is making, is in the digital world. It's a reflection, obviously, of the increase in personal computing power that we've got, and especially in the growth of the network, which is going to be the main focus of my comments. The stuff in the computers is information. Some people want to use that information in ways that horrifies other people. Disputants call on the legal system to settle the matter. And some people do get indicted for what they do with data and information. Now, the law is supposed to provide answers. And the law has to provide an answer. The law says yes or no, regardless of where the technology is, regardless of where the statutes are, regardless of the brain power of the judge that's involved. There's going to be an answer generated by the legal system. But because there is no consensus on what the rules are, we run into the problems that have brought a lot of us together here. The technology is growing too fast, there's too much myth and ignorance, and the sort of social consensus that Gail Thackeray hoped existed or is supposed to exist before the law comes into place doesn't exist, and it is not going to exist in the context of this extremely rapidly growing technology. So what happens instead is that laws are created to take the place of social consensus instead of erupting out of the social consensus. They're not backed by the consensus. And that's led to the problems that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to say it about three or four times, actually. We've had a request for the people in the back to continue their conversations a little bit out of the room. The federal and state governments have passed laws, hundreds of them. Every single state other than Vermont has a specific criminal code that is supposed to address these sorts of problems. We've got, they address the unauthorized access, the notion of unauthorized access and of data transmission. Other groups too, including a lot of the people here, have also called for laws. For example, regulations, bills of rights, a cyberspace constitution, that sort of thing. Other regulations of the electronic arena. My suggestion is that all of those things are really doomed. They're futile. The people who value data and information the most very often treat it with no honor. They take a perverse pride in its mutilation, in its infinite mutability. The apostles of the information age, John Perry Barlow, one of them, tells us that the wineskins have burst. Information belongs to us all. And of course, when information is as ubiquitous as sand, it can't be called property at all. But these same people believe deeply in the value of privacy, and they are in the vanguard of combating the government's efforts on the Clipper and related efforts. The attempts of the government, for example, to try and ban the export of strong encryption. They are in the vanguard of objections to government and corporate control over personal and credit information. These people see correctly that control over and access to information on the one hand and control and access over the citizenry are one and the same thing. But on the other side, we have law enforcement. Those charged with the enforcement of laws know very well that our movement to an information society is transforming these concepts of property. They think that if digital property can't be protected, then property as such is going to be eviscerated, destroyed, and with it one of the central foundations of the legal system. It's true. Tampering with data can cost millions of dollars. Some information is private. Some of it should be limited to so-called authorized personnel. The digital world, despite or as a result of its increasing size and influence, does not stop at the keyboard. It operates subway systems, nuclear power plants, and passenger aircraft in the economies of the developing world. Precisely because so much of what we call the digital world actually controls the physical world, we care a lot about what happens to data. So criminal law has to handle the real-world consequences of these electronic events. But most judges, juries, and prosecutors don't understand the technology. They don't understand how a telephone works. It's difficult to spend time and money on investigations of system break-ins. It's hard to ask for jail time when the only harm was temporary slowdown of a network. And it's troublesome to find a perpetrator who simply looked around a few files and perhaps left some electronic graffiti. Why lock somebody up for just sort of peeking over the digital shoulder? When a criminal justice system is wholly overwhelmed by traditional crimes of violence, murder, and drugs, and the rest of them, electronic crime takes a back seat. Contrary to some of the implications you've heard here today and in the newspapers, digital issues, computers and communication had nothing to do with the Polyclass deal. It had nothing to do with the Twin Towers bombing in New York. Those were traditional crimes that were solved with traditional means. It's too difficult and complicated to understand the digital stuff. There isn't enough time and interest and money to do it all, and so the electronic crime and data takes a back seat. That, in short, is a description of the ambivalence and confusion that we have, I think, over how to treat data and information. Now, the law does not understand this stuff, but it understands what property is. So for that reason, these developments in computer crime codes, these codes of the states and of the federal government that are supposed to address this stuff, are all based on this concept of property. And they do it two ways. One, they equate property with data, the transmit with an electron, with a switch from a zero to a one. And number two, then they proscribe doing things with that property. Laws address the interception of data, accessing data and symptoms, tampering with and altering data, frustrating the authorized use of data, and viewing others' data. Computer crimes first appropriate the entire digital world. This is the way these things are written now. They claim the right to control the movement of every single electron and every single fiber cable photon. And then these laws carve out the boundaries of these criminal behavior through this notion of unauthorized access. The model is the painting of beautiful borders, circumscribing each group of data, and then criminal behavior is breaching any of those borders in any way. The coverage of these laws is incredibly broad. Every computer and every attached device to a computer, every single communication facility that is, quote, related to or operating in conjunction with the computer system can be protected under federal law. In Pennsylvania, it can be a crime to interrupt the, quote, normal functioning of a system or organization, whatever that means. I don't. Federal law directly focuses on unauthorized access of a computing system, and it refines that by also making it a crime to exceed your authorized access to secure, for example, financial information. A 10-year jail term can be imposed for preventing others from their authorized use of a system. It's a federal felony to have an unauthorized access to a system for the purpose of any copying or taking or disclosing of possessing anything of value. As I said before, a thing of value is any kind of data whatsoever. Any access which exceeds the authority and which results in the altering of information or prevents somebody else from having access to it, perhaps only for a few seconds, I don't know, is a federal crime. And so you see how computer crime follows the traditional way that law has traditionally operated. Separable areas surrounding and defining each legally cognizable entity, like homes and properties and individuals surrounded by trespass law, webs of trade secret law and things like that that surround all the corporations. These are traditional rules, and the digital universe has been subject to exactly the same colonization by the legislatures. Now these efforts, like much of the law's attempts to play catch-up with technology, are too little and they're too late. The legal system's perpetually about a decade behind the technology. My paper goes into more detail of how you reach that roughly that 10-year period, but it's about a 10-year delay. And the price for that divergence, though, is paid by technology, which finds itself shackled by these laws. There are two reasons for the law's difficulty in treating electronic material as property. The first is that data is infinitely mutable, and so untraceable. And the second is the nature of the network. I'm not going to discuss today property and how that the ability to mutate property destroys the notion of using property for digital data. There's more of that in the paper. I'm going to focus here on the digital network. The truth is that we don't have access to separable information and data. We don't really have discrete data in separate, meaningfully separate data banks or a discrete CPU in every pod or garage. The slow, painful efforts of the legal system to accommodate the computer through these property-based criminal statutes are destroyed by the advent of the network. Lawmakers see communication devices and other connections simply as appendages to the computer. They see the images of a network as sort of as the medium by which data travels and by which criminals have their access into the vaults of data. The street, the image here is of street connecting homes, for example, empty air behind between communicating humans, or empty space between the stars. But that image is false, for the network reveals that there are no borders, and there never will be. The ultimate network machine is wholly wired, connecting every user to every database. This is a sort of single, multi-threaded, parallel processing machine, and it isn't. This image is not really far from reality. Just as electricity itself has no meaning absent the conducting wires, so too the evolving computer environment is essentially a unitary connected whole. This presents deep problems for applying the laws that we've got. There are problems with obscenity laws in Tennessee, applying them to BBS operators in Arkansas and California. There are problems with the U.S. trying to restrict the export of encryption software across physical U.S. borders, while billions of transfers within the 50 states are perfectly permissible. There are issues with applying classic telephone wiretap law to the interception of email within a company. It's not clear, quote, unauthorized access, that's the federal felony, has occurred, for example, when someone introduces into a system a virus. An authorized user introduces a virus into a system that was written by somebody who doesn't have access. We know the U.S. government can't insist on the right to record keystrokes at my own standalone PC, but the FBI wants the power to record these if they're sent by wire. Under the new regime that I've described, theft can include logging into the wrong partition. A felony erupts when an unwanted comment pops up on a sign-on screen, and you can get jail time for playing the network multiplayer game Doom and Falcon on your employer's network. Think of it this way. How many people here have played Doom? All right. How many people have played the network version? Yeah, you should. Those of you who haven't really should do it on a network. But think of it this way. Doom is sort of a Trojan horse. It's a virus that pretends to be a game. It can crash the system. Indeed, there are a host of unexpected behaviors that we've seen explode from the products of commercial vendors that could qualify as felonies under these new laws. For example, so-called compression software that slows down a system, operating systems that trash files, telecommunications devices that lose some piece of the communication. As some of you know, there's a feature in Windows OLE 2.0, which allows you to send a hidden program inside of a document. That's what's really going on. But this defeats many routine security techniques. Sounds like unauthorized access to me. But could this possibly be criminal unauthorized access? Crooks, we think, surely must intend to do evil before they're locked away. A noted programmer described it like this. He described how you can make a simple modification to a C compiler, which will be undetectable, cause miscompilations under a set series of circumstances. Then he said this, if this were not deliberate, it would be a compiler bug. Since it is deliberate, it should be called a Trojan horse. But this deliberate versus mistake dichotomy is not really how the criminal law operates. Reckless disregard of the consequences, knowing enough so that you ought to know what probably would happen if, that is usually enough for a conviction. One of my favorite jury instructions when I was a federal prosecutor was something like this, that we're all presumed to know and intend the ordinary consequences of our actions. That's a lot of consequences. Presumably someone at Microsoft knew of this OLE bug. Presumably Borland knew when it released the C++ 4.0 program, version 4.0 of C++, development tools, that it generated a rounding error. Both of these bugs, of course, destroy data. And this, you would say, under the current law, you might suggest that therefore both Borland and Microsoft ought to be indicted. This deliberate, for other reasons, right? They're too big. I don't think you're going to have to indict Borland. I think it's this deliberate mistake dichotomy also, this notion that, you know, if you do something deliberately, it's a crime, and if it's a mistake, it's just a bug. It also doesn't catch the problem. It doesn't really address the issues, for example, having to do with viruses. The Macintosh scores virus, and perhaps the internet worm, perhaps not, there's a debate there, they probably were not released intentionally into the general population. But in both cases, prosecutors would indict and secure a conviction under the new computer crime statutes. Is that too bizarre? A prosecution for a bug that eats data or provides an entry point for data modification? It's not bizarre at all. The decisions to indict are essentially unreviewable and often made by prosecutors with a weak grip on technology. Gail Thackeray is an exception. She knows what a computer is and a keyboard. That is very rare in this business. This ignorance also can be said to the juries that actually ultimately decide guilt. There are two essential aspects. I want to go for just about 5 minutes here, a little deeper into the nature of the network and why it causes the problems that I've been talking about. There are two aspects of the network that interest me here. One is what I call self-directed code, and the other is the connected databases that exist. Self-directed code means those programs that can be let loose to find their way and report back with some sort of result. These exist already in rudimentary form, everything from Borland to Microsoft spreadsheets to General Magic's draft telecommunications programs. These agents combine code, data, they're independent, sensitive to their context, and therefore they don't need complete instructions from their humans. In a sense, these agents are self-directing. They don't need to be supervised at all times. The point is to embody some sort of AI, artificial intelligence, and thus have them execute some unpredicted task. That key notion of an agent executing an unpredicted task is what ends up mattering a lot. The second aspect of networks that's interesting here is this worldwide hyperlink database, utterly transparent to the user. Already, many of the users of the internet are familiar with the World Wide Web. True global networking is a realizable goal and will happen rather soon, I think. Every network now accepts and operates with the notion of a logical drive, as opposed to the physical drive that's resident in some sort of physical space. The simple notion of a logical drive makes it plain that a network exists everywhere that a user can access. That's where the network is. Noting the physical location of data is pointless. So we have self-directing code in a worldwide habitat of hyperlinked data. That's the model. We have agents, therefore, communication so fast and transparent that the elements, that is the actors, you, the agents, the software, the communications, and the hardware, are swept up into the transmission stream. They lose all identity but for their existence as transmission agents. Each is a repeating station, no more than input and output, each a copper wire linked to another copper wire until we have a single, endlessly looping strand. This is zero culture, inhabited by these android shadow selves who fear no law, and they abide no punishment, and they feel no guilt. In this digital soup, we have a sort of a hyperlinked environment, and there is where we see the death of the barrier. We have no cells, we have no inside, we have no outside, we have no public world, we have no private world. What we do have is a network and the death of the sort of key dichotomy. It's fatal for the legal system, which depends for its very life on the existence of barriers. That's what the law does. It utters the distinction between this and that and then punishes the transgressor. But the android cells cannot be punished. So what's the problem? The problem is one of extreme difficulty, because while the law sort of evaporates as a network is perfected, the need for the law grows as the network expands to control the infrastructure of the real world. The essential connectivity of the network generates at once its power, its reactivity, and its striking vulnerability. And that's the nub of the problem. As I've noted before at the beginning, the solution to this has been to pass more and more laws, invoke new rights, new privileges, to heap laws on laws. Been done by the Gail Thackerays of the world, by the FBI, and by the people in this audience. This confusion regarding data information that I described at the beginning has been addressed in just this way by all parts of the political spectrum. The FBI wants more laws. Harvard Law School Professor Lawrence Tribe, in his inaugural address to CFP when it first started off, wants more laws. The National Security Agency wants more regulations. Employers want more rules on employee privacy rights. Online services such as Genie and Prodigy regulate inappropriate and offensive speech. Congress is considering new copyright laws to make it perfectly clear that electronic copying is copying. And this is the all-American way. More legislation, take no prisoners. The impetus is fueled by the cynical acceptance of the government, the legislature, law enforcement. that electronic reality really does exist as a sort of parallel universe. They've come to buy the proposition that virtual reality, what I've sort of termed tongue-in-cheek the electroverse, really does have an existence independent, legally speaking, of the day-to-day reality that's governed by traditional laws. The inhabitants of this place call it cyberspace, high frontier, new territory, like the moon, sort of some sort of new territory. The lawmakers have endorsed the schizophrenia pressed by the electrocognoscenti, and they've endorsed it out of fear, ignorance, and misunderstanding. How else to react to the omnipresent power of cyberspace? Well, take its unruly tenants at their word. They seem to know what they're talking about. Treat cyberspace like a competing reality. Regulate it, and then break it up into chunks called property. But I think that this alternative universe model provides a very bad model. Neither law nor technology benefits. The law founders and sinks into this sort of blue sea of the network. And the electronic community is on the verge of being regulated to death, ruled out of fear, and chained by broad and detailed laws that can make anything, even the movement of an electron, a federal felony. This notion of cyber law, or specific law that should apply in the electronic universe, I don't think makes any more sense than print law, newspaper law, video game law, or washing machine law. The network is not a place like the moon. It's a tool, like a tractor, or a pen, or Velcro. It's an extension of the physical, moral human beings who in turn are subject to the traditional legal system. We can have no law of place or property here. So the new computer crime statutes, heavy-handed regulation of data, and unauthorized access is wrong-headed. Computer crime is not really about unauthorized access. Nearly 80% of so-called computer criminals are actually insiders with verified access. The agents that I talked about in the past, the agents that wander the net and come back and report, actually accomplish their tasks through unpredicted. They're accomplishing unpredicted computer tasks, and therefore it's very hard to say that any evil has been intended in that way. Now, the battle of the metaphor is really what we're fighting here. It always erupts in the face of new and powerful technologies. Our imagination is fired, but our stability is threatened, so we seek precedent for our understanding. We use the property analogy, the metaphor of invaded homes and goods when systems are attacked, the illusions of space and universe. But this category mistake, I suggest. Computer-mediated space is no more space than DNA is the person, no more than digital signals are a picture or a novel. Bits and bytes are not the equivalent of the manifestations. The criminal law has no business here, for the network has no borders, and the autonomous space of hyper-perfect illusion and flawlessly recombinant culture is too slippery for any statute. So, we would be asked, I think, by law enforcement, do we just sort of let the wily hacker deploy with immunity? Should we let 1,000 viruses bloom? What's the reasonable role of the law in view of the fact that network computers really do operate the power plants, the banking, and the military, and other key infrastructures in the country? And this takes me to my final point, where I've been trying to get to here, this notion of control, the law being used as a method of control. The control that we need is not a legal problem. It's a social, moral, and technological problem. The law will not save us from the next full-scale polymorphic virus, but widely accepted social norms and technologies might. Back up the data, use firewalls to insulate machines and data, use smart cards and arbitrary changing passwords, employ private cancel bots, use real encryption for authenticity and privacy. Never make the mistake of believing that a computerized system is necessarily an improvement. Look at what happened with the IRS and their attempts to computerize that work. And think about not using computers at all for certain very, very high-risk tasks. When real people suffer real injury measured as real financial loss, then you indict and you convict those who really and demonstrably intended that harm. That's what the criminal code ought to be doing. If a jury of ordinary people using ordinary laws on fraud and theft wouldn't convict, then leave it alone. Put the armed criminals in a cell and leave the android shadows to their electric dreams. There are gray areas, obviously, between those two, but I think that there ought to be gray areas governed slowly, bit by bit, by developing codes of manner and custom, not to be crushed out by omnipotent criminal codes. It's 20 past 12. Copies of the paper, which is a little longer than my remarks, are available up here. Come on up and help yourself to a copy. People want to take questions now, fine. Thank you.